This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. Secretary of State Colin Powell is nearing the end of a trip to Asia aimed at gaining support for the Bush administration's policies on North Korea and Iraq. But the message on North Korea is not what the Bush administration wants to hear. China, as well as the outgoing president of South Korea and the foreign minister of Australia, are all urging one-on-one talks between the U.S. and North Korea. The Bush administration has been trying to convince North Korea's neighbors to participate in multilateral talks on Pyongyang's nuclear weapons program. The U.S. argues it is in the interest of other Asian nations to persuade North Korean leader Kim Jong-il to dismantle his country's nuclear weapons. What's at stake for North Korea's neighbors, and why are they resistant to multilateral talks? How could the U.S. convince other Asian nations to join them in talks with Pyongyang? Should the U.S. hold unilateral talks with North Korea? Do you believe North Korea poses a serious threat to the security of this country? Join the conversation. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. A bit later in the show, we'll also catch up with the latest news from the U.N. Security Council. But joining us now is NPR's Beijing correspondent, Rob Gifford. Rob, first of all, remind us, what's the purpose of Colin Powell's trip to Asia, and where has he been?
Well, the Secretary of State started off in Japan, and he's just been in China. He's just left China, in fact, for South Korea. South Korea is the last stop, and he's attending the inauguration tomorrow of the new South Korean president. And as you mentioned, there are two main issues on his agenda, and they are Iraq and North Korea. Iraq is somewhat distant from East Asia. We haven't seen really the opposition that some of the European countries have put up to U.S. aims in Iraq, and especially a possible war in Iraq. Really, what people in this region are worried about is North Korea. And so that's what's been the focus. And Colin Powell said today he had very positive talks with his Chinese counterparts.
He did. He put a very positive spin on those talks. But as soon as he left, China once again was calling for unilateral talks between the U.S. and North Korea, which is not what the U.S. wants, is it?
That's right. I think you probably have to distinguish between the tone and the substance of the talks. I think on the surface, the United States is very pleased to have China on board. Colin Powell was really very glowing in his praise for the Chinese, and that's not something we've heard here over the last decade or so, up until at least until 9/11. But I think the substance underneath, there are still a lot of disputes between, I wouldn't say disputes, that's probably going too far. I think there is still disagreement. The United States government has said very clearly it won't talk directly to Pyongyang. It sees that as rewarding bad behavior. And it believes that that's what the Clinton administration did in 1994 by doing a deal with the North Koreans that the North Koreans then reneged on. And so Colin Powell was adamant that he wanted to push for this multilateral forum to discuss North Korea. But the Chinese and actually everyone, again, as you mentioned, everybody in the region is coming out and saying, look, for goodness sake, you're kind of painting yourself into a corner here, Washington. The issue is with you. The North Koreans want to sign a non-aggression treaty with you, the United States. They're worried that after Iraq is finished, that the United States is going to go after North Korea. They're a member of Mr. Bush's infamous Axis of Evil, and they think that the United States is going to attack North Korea. So they want to talk with Washington, and frankly speaking, everybody in this region really believes that Washington needs to change its view and just get over it, if you like, and sit down and talk to the North Koreans. It's not very nice. It's not very pleasant. In effect, it is nuclear blackmail that the North Koreans are engaging in. But when you look at what the options are, it really, I think most people here feel it's the only thing that Washington can do, and it's got to bite the bullet and do it.
But the Bush administration seems to be arguing that all of these countries have a lot at stake here in this nuclear standoff with North Korea. Isn't that the case? Don't they have a lot at stake? Why wouldn't they want to engage in some kind of multilateral discussion about this?
I think they all do, and that's very clear. I mean, this is a dangerous neighborhood with North Korea saying that it's going to have, or not saying, but we believe that North Korea will have nuclear weapons within a few months if some deal is not struck, and possibly even if some deal is struck. But the main core of the issue is between is what Pyongyang says. It wants to do the deal with the United States because the United States is the what it sees as the threat to it. I mean, it's looking at what's happening in the Gulf now, and it's afraid that the U.S. is going to, you know, fly planes in from South Korea and start bombing North Korea. And the unfortunate thing is that North Korea has some trump cards here. It has a number of very strong cards up its sleeve. It's got this nuclear weapons program, and it's basically saying, look, you guys, you're not going to talk to us. We're going to have nuclear weapons within about 6 months. So they're able to sort of turn up the heat a bit. And again, you know, Washington is so focused on Iraq at the moment. People here in Northeast Asia, in South Korea, in Japan, in China, I'm sure over the last couple of days have been saying to Colin Powell, look, we know you're busy, but just you really got to get with the program, because within a few months, if you do not talk to these people, they are going to have nuclear weapons with all the implications that that holds for the United States. North Korea has ballistic missiles. It gets most of its money at the moment by selling ballistic missiles to countries that the United States doesn't like, many of them. If it has nuclear weapons, just think, who's it going to sell that nuclear technology to? To other rogue states, possibly. Possibly even to terrorist groups that want to use nuclear weapons against the United States. So this is really an issue of the utmost importance, people in this region are saying. And even though Washington's busy with Iraq, it must give more attention to this issue.
With regard to U.S. policy on Iraq, how much success did Secretary of State Powell have in getting consensus or agreement from Asian nations on its approach to that?
I think the key nation is actually China. I think Japan and South Korea are pretty much on board. They're not, I think, internationally, as everybody knows, there's a lot of concern about the U.S. plans in the Gulf. The key issue, the key country is China, because, of course, China has a veto on the Security Council. Now, we know now that this second resolution is going to be tabled in the United Nations. The crucial issue has been trying to persuade China that it should not veto the second resolution. And most people I speak to here, officials and analysts, say the chances are, and probably what the Chinese hinted at today to Colin Powell, the chances are they will not veto that. They're not overly happy either, to be frank, about Washington going in and attacking another country. But they don't have enough interests in Iraq to annoy the United States that much by vetoing the second resolution so that they would destroy their suddenly very friendly relationship with the United States.
Well, I know it's the middle of the night for you, Rob, and I thank you so much for getting up and joining us on Talk of the Nation today.
I think I've lost you, Lynn. Just say that again.
Just thanks so much for joining us, Rob.
Okay, yeah, okay. It is the middle of the night. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Rob Gifford is NPR's Beijing correspondent, and he joined us from his home in Beijing. Joining us now from his office in Medford, Massachusetts, is the dean of the Fletcher School at Tufts University, Stephen Bosworth. He also served as the U.S. ambassador to South Korea and as the president of the United States Japan Foundation. Thanks for joining us so much, Mr. Bosworth.
My pleasure.
Let me ask you first, how vital is it that the U.S. and South Korea remain in step regarding North Korea?
Well, I think neither of us has the possibility of making much progress in relationships with North Korea unless we can act together in harmony. I think that one of the great problems that we face now is, in fact, this rift that we have in our relationship with South Korea.
Well, outgoing South Korean President Kim Dae-jung just said that he believes that the possibility of war on the Korean Peninsula is slight. Now, would you say that that's the prevailing opinion in the South?
Yes, I would. I think that the South Koreans, for the most part, I mean, they've lived with this situation now for five decades. So for the most part, They are not exactly inured to it, but they do not react with great alarm when the level of tension goes up as it has.
It seems almost as if, I mean, some of the reports out of South Korea quote officials as saying the U.S. is exaggerating the situation, the North Korean threat, calling officials in Washington amateurs. I mean, it almost sounds as if they're more upset with Washington than Pyongyang. Why is that?
Well, there's been a shift in South Korean public opinion with regard to the U.S. over the last year and a half or so. I don't think this shift is necessarily permanent, although it does reflect a generational change in the South. But in many ways, people in South Korea are reflecting in what they say about the United States and North Korea, they're reflecting a view that somehow the U.S. has taken, since the Bush administration was inaugurated, a very hard-line posture toward the North, a policy line that cuts across the South's efforts to promote a strategy of reconciliation or at least lowering of tensions.
Let's try and take a call here, Mr. Bodsworth. Mary in Rockford, Illinois. Hello, Mary.
Hello.
Go ahead.
I wanted to know why these countries want us to now act unilaterally with North Korea when they don't want us to act unilaterally with Iraq.
Well, I think it's a question of what they think will work. They think that given the history of the U.S. relationship with North Korea and what North Korea is saying, that the best prospect for lowering the heat in this particular crisis is for the United States to engage directly with North Korea. We, on our part, in a somewhat, I think the question could also be asked in an interesting fashion about why we are now so disposed to act multilaterally with regard to North Korea.
Mm-hmm.
I think
perhaps that's because when we acted unilaterally on the last treaty, they reneged on it. So maybe we're thinking that if Asian countries get involved, there might be more pressure on them to stick with the treaty.
That may be part of their thinking, indeed. Now, but it's important to remember that we did not, the last time around, do it unilaterally. We were the only country that signed the agreement, but we did so with the full public and private support of both South Korea and Japan.
Thanks so much for your call, Mary. What about Japan? We haven't really talked very much about Japan. Japan seems to be treading very lightly about all this and its comments.
They are indeed, and they will continue to tread lightly.
Why is that?
Well, because, first of all, they may be the country most threatened by a North Korean nuclear capacity. This poses for Japan a real challenge to what has been their traditional policy of the last 50 years of not developing the ability to project military force outside of the immediate territory of Japan. And, in fact, one prominent Japanese official was quoted very recently as saying that this may raise the need for Japan to develop the capacity to take its own preemptive action against threats from North Korea.
How capable is Japan of defending itself?
On defending itself in a narrow sense, quite capable in terms of being able to project military force into North Korea, not very capable at all.
And what are Japanese-South Korean relations like?
They're better than they were, say, 5 years ago, but even in South Korea, there is a very vivid and sharp memory of the experience of the Japanese colonial period, which was not a happy experience for any Koreans. And that didn't end, of course, until the end of World War II. So that there is still a fair amount of suspicion, if not to say animosity, on the part of some South Koreans toward the Japanese. That being said, younger generations of South Koreans, I think, view Japan in a much more favorable light than did their parents and grandparents.
We're talking about Secretary Powell's trip to Asia. You can call us at 800-989-TALK. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. We're talking about Secretary of State Powell's trip to Asia, what he's been able to accomplish, what he's been trying to accomplish. And you're invited to join the discussion. How do you think the U.S. should proceed with North Korea? Give us a call at 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. Our guest is Stephen Bosworth. He's the dean of the Fletcher School at Tufts University. He joins us from his office in Massachusetts. And joining us now here in Studio 3A is David Michael Lampton. He is the director of the China Studies Program at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. Thanks for joining us.
Good to be with you.
Let's turn to China now for a moment. When Secretary of State Powell left Beijing today, as we've already heard from Rob Gifford, he put a pretty positive spin on his talks with Chinese leaders. He also said that Beijing wants to work quietly with North Korea. Now, what did he mean by that, and what can Beijing do quietly? What can they do behind the scenes?
Well, first of all, the Chinese have a lot of experience living next to the North Koreans, and much of it's been unhappy. And I think they have a view of the North Koreans that the more they are publicly confronted, the more they're backed into a corner, the more unmanageable they become. And the Chinese know that they provide 50% of the food going into North Korea and over 60-70% of the energy supplies. So China has leverage, but they believe to exercise that leverage subtly and behind the scenes is going to be more effective than having the North Koreans lose face publicly, get their back up, and be even more difficult to deal with than they are. And I think there's some merit to that position. I think it's at our peril that we don't pay and take attention seriously to what the Chinese are saying.
Eventually, if this comes to the UN Security Council, China will play a major role.
Right, but I think the Chinese are going to wait before they put their big pressure, to the degree they're going to, on the North Koreans, until they see the United States adopting a policy and a line they think will be productive. And that is, talk to the North Koreans bilaterally, take seriously their concerns about a non-aggression agreement of some sort, and at least test the proposition that the North Koreans are trying to use their nuclear program as a bargaining chip to get security guarantees out of the United States. That may not be the purpose, but China's not going to put whatever pressure maximal it's willing to until they think the United States has a line that at least offers the prospect of being productive.
Yeah. The South Koreans seem to be saying, certainly at least publicly, many of them, that they don't believe that North Korea is really as great a threat as the United States is making it out to be. Is that, how would the Chinese assess that threat?
I think they would have a similar view. I met with with a group that I was with, met with President Zhang and the defense minister, the head of military intelligence in China in the later part of November. We talked about all of these issues. The Chinese will tell you candidly they don't know exactly what the North Koreans have, and I believe them. They don't know. But they suspect that the North Koreans are not as far along as at least American worst-case analysis fears they might be. And so I think the Chinese enter this thinking there's probably more time to deal with this, and therefore don't ratchet it up as a crisis yet. And you, the Americans, should be willing to talk quietly behind the scenes with the North Koreans and at least explore whether or not they're trying to use this as a bargaining chip to get more security from the United States.
Something interesting that's coming out in all this is the sort of shifting relationship between the U.S. and China. I mean, not so long ago, I don't think the U.S. would have been patting the Chinese leaders on the back and saying how happy they are and how great their talks have been.
Well, I think George W. Bush has gone on a great odyssey in his China policy in his first 2 years. He came in talking about a competitor. The Defense Department came out talking about a rising specter, a rising power in Asia. But now, in fact, I think the administration has seen that there are graver threats to U.S. national security than China, at least for the immediate and foreseeable future, and that the Chinese are becoming a more cooperative power, willing to use their influence in ways that are compatible with American interests, at least upon occasion. And particularly, we've seen that with respect to Iraq. Your earlier segment was debating whether China might veto an Iraq resolution. I believe that's almost inconceivable. I think the question is, will they abstain? And it's even conceivable, though I wouldn't predict it, that they would vote in favor of it. Hmm. You'll remember on the 1441 on November 8th, surprised many people, the Chinese voted for that resolution. They didn't abstain. My sense is that Secretary Powell probably went away from those meetings knowing at least the Chinese aren't going to veto this, and they might even conceivably support it.
Stephen Bosworth, let me bring you back into the discussion, and let me address this really to both of you, and maybe Stephen Bosworth, you could take it first. With the U.S. Pushing for sort of some kind of multilateral talks, which it looks like aren't going to happen, but I'm curious about the multilateral relationships in Asia and how well all these nations get along. We talked a little bit earlier, Stephen Bosworth, about China and about South Korea and Japan. What about South Korea and China?
Well, actually, the South Korean relationship with China has blossomed in the last decade or so. They went from not having any diplomatic relations at all in the early 1990s to a position now where it's one of the most vibrant relationships that South Korea has, one of the most important in commercial terms, and increasingly important in political terms. And I think China would view the relationship in about the same way. So that relationship has prospered in the last decade.
I would just add, and I fully agree with Stephen, this is a blossoming relationship. The Chinese-South Korean economic relationship absolutely dwarfs now the North Korean relationship with the Chinese. Also, the South Koreans are major now investors, foreign direct investors in China in a range of industries. And also, I think the Chinese see the South Koreans now in some sense of distancing themselves from the U.S. a bit, as was mentioned in the earlier in this program, and see that the South Koreans really want to play a mediating role in some sense between China, or a balancer in a triangular relationship. And so I think the Chinese are quite happy with the way their relations with South Korea are going.
I would just note, David, that as the Chinese have invested more and more in their relationship with the South Koreans, the North Koreans view China with increased resentment because for a long time they were the preferred Korean partner for China, and they've now been put very much in the background.
Right, and I just add to that the Chinese are trying to, I think, have a long-range view on North Korea and get them to move down the road of reform. Opening reform, bringing in foreign business as a first step to try and change the very character of the North Korean regime. And I think the North Koreans, obviously, Kim Jong-il in particular, on the one hand, think that may be the way they have to go, but are very distrustful of its implications for their future political system.
Let's see if we can get a caller involved here. We're discussing Secretary of State Colin Powell's trip to Asia. If you'd like to join our discussion, the number is 1-800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. And David in West Windsor, New Jersey. Hello. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My question is the following. It's my understanding that the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty not only commits non-nuclear signatories not to get nuclear weapons, but also commits nuclear power signatories eventually to get rid of their nuclear weapons. And I haven't seen any progress whatsoever been made toward that, and I haven't even heard it mentioned. And I wonder if your guests could comment on that.
Mr. Lampton?
Well, I think you're right. There's the general expectation in many of the arms control agreements of the 70s and thereafter that the major nuclear powers would begin to disarm, particularly nuclear. It's also true, though, that the United States and the Russians have agreed to a very substantial reduction in numbers of warheads. So I think that the fact is that the major nuclear powers, China has kept a low number of warheads. The U.S. and Russia are reducing the number. So I think we're moving in that direction, but we're still dealing with such high numbers and such explosive power that I'm sure to the rest of the world that doesn't look like reduction of too great magnitude.
Did you want to add anything to that,
no,
Stephen Bosworth?
That answers my question. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thanks very much.
Bye-bye.
Okay. We have a call from Lee, and she is on the road near Atlanta, I think. Hello, Lee?
Yes, I am.
Hi. Go ahead.
Thank you. And I have the observation that a young woman who was speaking maybe 10 minutes ago was bringing up. And to me, it seems that it would it would make much more sense for the people who surround Korea, North Korea, like China, like Japan, the countries who have a great deal of interest in seeing that things go smoothly and quietly in their spot on the world should be involved in this. Frankly, I know that because we are big number one in this world, that everybody thinks they have to go crying to mommy and make mommy fix it. But I think it's a much more adult for those people to take care of their problems themselves. I don't know what's wrong with that.
Mr. Stephen Bosworth?
Well, I don't think anything's wrong with that. And I think in many ways that is the trend which, rightly or wrongly, we now find ourselves on. But I think it is still the fact that to deal with North Korea requires the very direct involvement of the United States, because for various reasons it is the United States that North Korea sees as the major threat to its survival. And unless we are disposed to getting engaged with them, we are not going to be able to substitute for ourselves some multilateral grouping of countries in the region. Also, if we want to continue to play a role of leadership in the region, we have to be willing to exercise that leadership.
Stephen Bosworth, what are South Korea's priorities in terms of its own relationship with the North? What does it want?
What South Korea wants is a gradual process of lowering of tensions, eventually reconciliation, or at least a modus vivendi with the North. The South Koreans, for the most part, do not want early reunification, because they understand that reunification would likely only result from the collapse of North Korea. They do not want to have to deal with the economic and political consequences of a collapse. So they want to find ways to increase their influence over North Korea through more economic connectedness, but they do not want to push North Korea to the brink. They see the current U.S. administration as having a very ambiguous policy, with some in the administration very visibly desiring to bring about a change of regime in North Korea. That frightens the South, because they fear that that could well result in military conflict.
And do they really feel not much of a threat from a thriving nuclear weapons program in the North? I mean, do they really
feel? They don't feel that nuclear weapons per se increase the threat to them very much. Remember, the North already has 11,000 to 12,000 artillery tubes that have greater metropolitan Seoul well within range, that could put an estimated 50,000 artillery rounds per minute, per hour, into downtown Seoul. That, for the South Koreans, is the real threat, not the possibility that the North may have nuclear weapons.
Yeah. You wanted to add something?
Well, I think we also have to look at the priorities and interests the Chinese have. And there's a Korean minority of substantial size in northeast China, across the border from North Korea. I think the first Chinese priority is not nuclear weapons in the North. It's avoiding a collapse in the North that would spew large numbers of refugees into a North China. And that's, in a sense, a mirror image fear of the South Koreans. Also, there's not only the question of priorities, that is, China may fear collapse more than nuclear weapons, there's the question of means. And the U.S. is afraid that the U.S. is too reliant or too sort of knee-jerk in the direction of economic sanctions and or the preemptive use of military force. In other words, they're afraid we would use the means that would jeopardize their primary security interest, which is avoiding collapse in North Korea. So I think the Chinese are trying to play a responsible role, but they also have their interests and they also have their understanding of what means would be most effective.
David Michael Lampton is the director of the China Studies Program at Johns Hopkins University's School of Advanced International Studies. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. If you'd like to join our discussion on the implications of Secretary of State Colin Powell's trip to Asia, give us a call. The number is 1-800-989-8255. And on the line with us now from Raleigh, North Carolina, is Richard. Hi, Richard.
Hello.
Go ahead.
I would like to know, why can't the United States take the initiative and sign a non-aggression treaty with North Korea, but tie it in with an agreement to demilitarize the DMZ, thus making the whole area safer. And I'll hang up and listen to your answer.
Okay, thanks so much.
Thank you.
David Michael Lambton?
Well, first of all, I think most Americans, and when I was in China, we were trying to convey to the Chinese how much the North Koreans have damaged their credibility. The fact of the matter is that they signed a framework agreement in 1994, and probably already at that time they were pursuing a covert nuclear uranium enrichment program. And so any American politician or responsible policymaker is going to ask, why do you sign agreements with a country which demonstrates very little interest in observing those commitments? So I think that is part of the reason that the Bush administration reluctant to sign any non-aggression agreement. On the other hand, there's the practical matter, and the practical matter is I think we're not going to make progress with North Korea unless we do sit down bilaterally, and I believe, but I'm not sure, but I believe that their primary concern is to get a promise of the non-use of force by the United States against North Korea. They look at what is happening to Iraq. They look at the national security strategy of the United States in September of last year, which talks about preemption, and I think they are genuinely afraid they might be next on the list.
I think that's correct. You know, for many Americans, we find it somewhat ridiculous that a country like North Korea would fear that we are about to attack it. But indeed, that's what the North Koreans, I think, genuinely are fearful of.
And we have an email here from Richard Averett who says, I believe North Korea poses a far bigger threat to the peace and stability of the world than does Iraq at the moment. With UN inspectors combing Iraq, it is in no position to threaten neighbors at the moment, whereas the North Korean regime has made serious threats towards the U.S. and the entire region. And just to conclude, maybe both of you could, what is your assessment of the threat of North Korea at this time? Has the United States overblown it, as some Asian leaders are saying, or how serious is the threat? Let's start with you, David Michael Lambton.
Well, I guess I think that it's certainly a serious problem and that we've got to devote more attention to it, and we have to be willing to sit down bilaterally with the North Koreans with the understanding and consultation with Japan and the Republic of Korea and China. We have to have a unified game plan, but we've got to sit down with the North Koreans. I think, however, there are a few reassuring aspects in a generally unreassuring situation, and that is the North Koreans have not used a force, let's say, at least military force as opposed to terrorism and idiosyncratic incidents since the 1950s. Iraq, on the other hand, has used force against its neighbors and in much more recent terms, and also is talking about doing so in the future. So I think it's we've got time on North Korea, but we've got to get serious and have the right strategy.
We're going to have to end on that note because we are out of time at this moment. Thanks to both of you for joining us. Stephen Bosworth joined us from his office in Medford, Massachusetts. He is the dean of the Fletcher School, Tufts University, and the former ambassador to South Korea. David Michael Lambton is the director of the China Studies Program at Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.